a follow-on from Brother Phil's address last night on the King of the North. This morning, we'll be looking at who is the King of the South and how can he be identified from a scriptural perspective. And secondly, we'll be looking briefly at the character and role outlined in the scriptures for the latter-day King of the South. Our study this morning will predominantly be around Daniel chapter 11, the last few verses, and Ezekiel 38. But in our efforts to make certain the identity of the King of the South, we will be turning to many passages throughout the scriptures during our studies together. We want to turn to the 11th chapter of Daniel, but before we do, we want to consider for a moment the scriptural context as to how the nations are characterized under that term, latter days. Now, in the exposition of Daniel, Brother Thomas makes the point that the term latter days is not referring explicitly to the last 200 years, or the last 100 years, or the last 10 years. From a scriptural point of view, we aren't yet living in the latter days, but specifically to the time of trouble. It's when these things burst forth upon the nations that we are then living in the latter days. Now, Daniel, in his 12th chapter, describes these times in the latter days as a time of trouble such as never was. But we know, brethren and sisters, don't we, that this time of trouble is depicted in several other places in the scriptures. I'll make this point absolutely clear. Joel 3 will help us in that direction. Joel chapter 3 and verse 16. This is on the point as to the state of affairs of the nations. Yahweh, verse 16, also shall roar out of Zion and utter his voice from Jerusalem. From the heavens and the earth shall shake. But Yahweh will be the hope of his people and the strength of the children of Israel. Just imagine that. This is not a wild dog or a wild wolf or a lion roaring out of Zion. It is Yahweh in his might going forth and roaring. Isaiah chapter 2, verse 17. Let us think about these words carefully, brethren and sisters. Verse 17, and the loftiness of man shall be bowed down, and the haughtiness of men shall be made low. And Yahweh alone shall be exalted in that day, and the idols he shall utterly abolish. They shall go into the holes of the rocks and into the caves of the earth, for fear of Yahweh and for the glory of his majesty, when he ariseth to shake terribly the earth. In that day a man shall cast his idols of silver and his idols of gold, which they made, each one for himself to worship, and to the moulds and to the bats, to go into the clefts of the rocks and into the tops of the ragged rocks, for fear of Yahweh, and for the glory of his majesty, when he ariseth to shake terribly the earth. A few more quotes. Psalm 2. Verse 9, Psalm 2 and verse 9, thou shalt break them, that's the heathen, the nations, of verse 8, with a rod of iron. Thou shalt dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel. Brother Phil was showing the two pots that Sister Jan had made. He was showing them last Sunday. And he said that Brother Richard had gone to long lengths to say, you know, to be very careful with them because a lot of effort had gone into them. But he and Sister Jan will be very aware that if you drop a pot like that, they do end up in hundreds of little pieces. Think about it, brethren and sisters. The nations are characterized in exactly the same light. The nations are characterized in the same light. They are to be dashed in pieces, like a potter's vessel, by the hand of the Almighty. Psalm 46. God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Therefore will not we fear, though the earth be removed, and though the mountains be carried into the midst of the sea, though the waters thereof roar and be troubled, though the mountains shake with the swelling thereof. There is a river, the streams whereof shall make glad the city of God, the holy place of the tabernacles of the Most High. God is in the midst of her. She shall not be moved. God shall help her, and that right early. The heathen raged. The kingdoms were moved. He uttered his voice. The earth melted. Yahweh of armies is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge. Come, behold the works of the Lord, or Yahweh. What desolations he hath made in the earth. He maketh wars to cease unto the end of the earth. He breaketh the bow and cutteth the spear in sunder. He burneth the chariot in the fire. Be still and know that I am God. I will be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted in the earth. And Yahweh of armies is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge. Final one on this point, because we did really want to drive that point home as to what the nations, what state they were in. We haven't seen anything yet in the earth that comes close, even close. World War I and World War II is nothing in comparison to what is about to happen in the earth. Psalm 149. Praise ye Yahweh, sing unto Yahweh a new song and his praise in the congregation of saints. Let Israel rejoice in him that made him. Let the children of Zion be joyful in their king. Let them praise his name in the dance. Let them sing praises unto him with the timbrel and the harp. For Yahweh taketh pleasure in his people. He will beautify the meek with salvation. Let the saints be joyful in glory. Let them sing aloud upon their beds. Let the high praises of God be in their mouth, and a two-edged sword in their hand, to execute vengeance upon the nations and punishments upon the people, to bind their kings with chains and their nobles with fetters of iron, to execute upon them the judgment written. This honor have all his saints. Praise Yahweh. There are many verses we could turn to show how these scriptures portray the time of the latter days as being a time where God's anger and his fury is poured out upon a wicked world who are anti-Semitic. The sword is drawn, execution of judgment described, a world in chaos is graphically portrayed. Daniel chapter 2, as we well know, portrays it as the kingdoms of men being smashed up and ground to powder. The nations are to be reduced to rubble. Interestingly enough, I was reading an article by Brother Grocott the other day, and he said, what a wonderful work it will be for those who are accepted post-judgment, he said, to take apart what is left He says the cities may still stand. Huge office buildings, huge factories will be the work of the saints and the mortal population to dismantle every idol, everything that is presently wrong with the earth today, and in its place establish an infrastructure in the world that will be conducive once again to the worship of God. And do you know, brethren and sisters, what the exciting part to all of this is? We might not be living in the last days, but we are living on the eve of the latter days. In Brother Thomas's days, as Brother Phil alluded to yesterday evening, in his days, as the Zionist movement was in its embryo and as the power of the Turk was about to be reduced in the drying up of the Euphrates, the disintegration of the Ottoman Empire, as we can consider in the book of the Apocalypse, chapter 16, verse 12, the events which are part of our recent history were matters of prophecy for our pioneer brethren. They had not seen the Balfour Declaration and the liberation of the Jews. They had not seen Israel become a state. They had not seen Jerusalem becoming the Jews' capital city in 1967. For them, they were matters of anticipation, future perspectives. Just as they have been fulfilled in the lifetime of our older members here today, soon, the things we are talking about this weekend, which are matters of our anticipation, subject of prophecy, yet to be fulfilled, will be fulfilled imminently in the earth. How exciting is that? Let us never take these things lightly. We don't have years ahead of us. We have days. And so let us, brethren and sisters, take stock and ensure that we are prepared, a people watching, our lamps trimmed, well filled with the golden oil. The book of Daniel, as we all know, is a book which describes in great prophetical detail the theme of the kingdom of men versus the kingdom of God. It has been the great theme of conflict right from the start, and will continue to be the theme until the time arrives mentioned in the Apocalypse chapter 11 verse 15, the kingdoms of this world have become the kingdom of our Lord and of his Christ. Brother Philip drew our attention last evening to the rising up of the little horn. And we know that horns in Scripture are a symbol or depiction of power and might. Horns in Scripture are a symbol or depiction of power and might. And so to the King of the South. Well, the King of the South is mentioned a few times in the 11th chapter of Daniel. The phrase was originally applied to Ptolemy's slice of the divided Greek Empire, which Brother Phil alluded to once again last night, applicable to Egypt. Daniel chapter 11 traces the history of that power from the time when the Greek Empire was divided towards the four winds of heaven until the rise of the Roman power and beyond. The latter-day king of the south starts from the last five or six verses of this chapter 11, and then we switch completely. We switch completely as to who is identified as the king of the south. So I think we would do well now to turn to Daniel chapter 11, if we may. It's interesting, brethren and sisters, to note that whenever you read anything written by the pioneers in relation to this subject, They don't end at verse 45 of chapter 11. They finish, I've noticed Brother Thomas, and especially Brother Roberts, finishing at verse 3 of the 12th chapter. So let us read those verses. And at the time of the end, verse 40, shall the king of the south push at him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots and with horsemen and with many ships. And he shall enter into the countries and shall overflow and pass over. He shall enter also into the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown. But these shall escape out of his hand, even Edom and Moab and the chief of the children of Ammon. He shall stretch forth his hand also upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. The land of Egypt shall not escape. But he shall have power over the treasures of gold and of silver, and over all the precious things of Egypt. And the Libyans and the Ethiopians shall be at his steps. The tidings out of the east and out of the north shall trouble him. Therefore he shall go forth with great fury to destroy, and utterly to make away many. And he shall plant the tabernacles of his palace between the seas in the glorious holy mountain. Yet he shall come to his end, and none shall help him. And at that time shall Michael stand up, the great prince, which standeth for the children of thy people. And there shall be a time of trouble, such as never was since there was a nation, even to that same time. And at that time thy people shall be delivered, every one that shall be found written in the book. And many of them that sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, and some to shame and everlasting contempt. And they that be wise shall shine as the brightness of the firmament, and they that turn many to righteousness, as the stars forever and ever. Let's take a brief look at Brother Roberts' explanation of these verses, if we may. So, beginning at verse 41, he says, he shall enter also into the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown, but these shall escape out of his hand, even Edom and Moab, and the chief of the children of Ammon. Brother Robert says, the fulfillment is likely to take this shape. Russia, after overwhelming Turkey, will enter and subdue the Holy Land, but the southeastern district of the country will escape because of the presence there of a power defending Israel, namely Britain, the merchants of Tarshish, and all the young lions thereof. Verse 42. He shall stretch forth his hand also upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. Brother Robert says, Russia will overrun adjacent countries and expel British power from Egypt. Britain is to be expelled from the land of Egypt with the cooperation of France and one of the many peoples with her. That's verse 6 of Ezekiel 38. Verse 43. But he shall have power over the treasures of gold and silver, and over all the precious things of Egypt, and the Libyans and the Ethiopians shall be at his steps. Brother Robert says she will lay her hands on the Egyptian wealth piled up under British management, the dervishes and other African races cooperating. But then, verse 44, tidings out of the east and out of the north shall trouble him. Therefore he shall go forth with great fury to destroy, and utterly to make away many. Brother Robert says, in regard to this, intelligence from India and England of immense preparations to oppose him exasperates him and rouses him to great endeavours. So this is talking about Russia, the Gordian host, all that is with her, becomes exasperated by the Tarshish power. And through that exasperation, Russia, and the Gordian host, is roused to him to great endeavours. Verse 45, he shall plant the tabernacles of his palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain, yet he shall come to his end and none shall help him. Brother Robert says he entrenches himself at Jerusalem after the capture and pillage of that city in Zechariah 14 verse 1, and appearances are in favour of his becoming Lord of the Fast, when without British effort he is suddenly overthrown. And then chapter 12, verse 1, and at that time shall Michael stand up, the great prince, which standeth for the children of thy people. And there shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation, even to that same time. And at that time thy people shall be delivered, every one that shall be found written in the book. Concerning this, Brother Roberts writes, "But at that time, Michael, Israel's angel prince, intervenes, and the Lord himself goes forth with a multitude of the angels, as per Joel 3 and verse 11, and Matthew 16 verse 27, who rains supernatural ruin on the assembled military hosts, in Zechariah 14 and verse 3. There ensues a time of trouble such as the world has never seen. The world is to be punished for its iniquity by Christ returned in Isaiah 26 and verse 21 and 2 Thessalonians 1 verses 7 and 8. And these are the passages that we are all familiar with. And the multitude of slain will be worldwide as per Jeremiah 25, 33. At that time, scattered Israel returns from the four quarters of the earth. Verse 2, and many of them that sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, and some to shame and everlasting contempt. Brother Robert says at the time, but earlier in the program, the responsible dead rise, the divinely approved to die no more, but others to suffer the shame and contempt awaiting those who have been unfaithful to divine privileges in their lifetime. Finally, to close this part, verse 3, and they that be wise shall shine as the brightness of the firmament, and they that turn many to righteousness as the stars forever and ever. Verse 3, Brother Roberts says, the former will enter upon and shine in the glory of the kingdom of God to be set up in all the earth, in which they will reign forever. It's pretty clear then, isn't it, brethren and sisters, that Daniel 11 is all about these two magnificent conflicting powers. The king of the north and the king of the south. They are conflicting powers. There are no alliances whatsoever between them. Their relationship here is depicted as one pushing against the other. It is truly a king of north versus king of south scenario. Before we go any further, it is worthwhile spending a little bit of time going through various passages of scripture to help us identify who this king of the south is. The object, the ultimate object in the divine plan, of course, is to get to the point where the Gentiles shall see Israel's glory. Yahweh ruling in the kingdoms of men brings about a situation where the rebels in Israel are purged. Two-thirds of them are wiped out, and the remnants are those to whom Yahweh gives a new heart and a new spirit, when they shall be the joy of the whole earth. Hymn 127 reads, for Zion's sake I will not rest, saith God, nor hold my peace, until Jerusalem be blessed, and Judah's sorrow cease. Until her righteousness return, as day break after night, the lamp of her salvation burn with everlasting light. The Gentiles shall see, shall her glory see, and kings declare her fame. Appointed unto her shall be a new and holy name. Go through, prepare thy ways. The gates wide open spread, the standard of the people raised, to glorious triumph led. In every clime, through every land, proclaim the joyful word. The holy people are at hand, redeemed of the Lord. Before this time, we know that the scriptures speak of the Jews as still being a largely scattered people. Just come quickly to Ezekiel 36, verse 36. Ezekiel 36, verse 36. Then the nations that are left round about you shall know that I, Yahweh, build the ruined places and plant that was desolate. I, Yahweh, have spoken it, and I will do it. Jeremiah 30, verses 7 to 10, speaks about Israel being saved from afar. Jeremiah 32 and verse 37 speaks about gathering them out of all countries and causing them to dwell safely. So, at the time gathered from afar, and they will be gathered out of all countries. We're in Ezekiel. Let us have a look at verses 18. Actually, have a look at that one in your own time, otherwise we're going to really run out of time this morning. It's Ezekiel 36, in your own time, verses 18 to 29, which shows Israel being scattered and then brought back. Yeah. Only about a third of the Jews are back in the land even today. Most from the areas we know of the Holy Roman Empire. But they are, as we have just said, to be gathered from all nations. Jeremiah, another quote here, chapter 31, verses 8 to 10, again speaks of the isles being afar off. And we're going to have a look. We're not going to turn there because we'll come and have a look at this in a moment. Isaiah 24, verses 15 to 16, speaks of the isles of the sea, the uttermost parts of the earth. Let's go there, actually, if we can. Isaiah 24, verses 15 and 16. Wherefore, glorify ye Yahweh in the fires, even the name of Yahweh Elohim of Israel, in the isles of the sea, from the uttermost part of the earth have we heard songs, even glory to the righteous. But I said, my leanness, woe unto me, the treacherous dealers have dealt treacherously, yea, the treacherous dealers have dealt very treacherously. Now, some translations render the uttermost part of the earth as the wing or skirt of the earth, denoting perhaps the most outstretched part. In Isaiah 45 and verse 5, we have a further reference to them being gathered from the ends of the earth. Jacinius, in relation to isles and coasts, says, distant maritime lands, and coasts being the extreme regions of the earth. But in Isaiah, so we'd like to turn to Isaiah 49 and verse 1. Listen, O isles, unto me, and hearken, ye people from far. Yahweh hath called me from the womb, from the bowels of my mouth hath he made mention of my name. Verse 22. Thus saith the Adonai Yahweh, behold, I will lift up mine hand to the Gentiles, and set up my standard to the people, and they shall bring thy sons in their arms, and thy daughters shall be carried upon their shoulders. Over a page to chapter 51, and verses 5 and 11. My righteousness, verse 5, is near, my salvation is gone forth, and mine arm shall judge the people. The isles shall wait upon me, and on mine arm shall they trust. Verse 11. Therefore the redeemed of Yahweh shall return, and come with singing unto Zion, and everlasting joy shall be upon their head. They shall obtain gladness and joy, and sorrow and mourning shall flee away. Finally, on this point, Isaiah 60 and verse 9, surely the isles shall wait for me, and the ships of Tarshish first, to bring thy sons from far, their silver and their gold with them, unto the name of Yahweh thy Elohim, and to the Holy One of Israel, because he hath glorified thee. Now, brothers and sisters, just as perhaps the Assyrians, Babylon and Rome in the past have been God's instruments to disperse the Jews, we'll remember that under Cyrus, God used Cyrus as an agent for their return at around about 538 BC. And so there is a latter-day power that will also be used as an instrument of God to protect the Jews and to bring them back to their land. And so the big question is, who is this Tarshish power? What does the Bible say about its mission? What clues are there to their identity? Well, there are 27 references to Tarshish in the Old Testament, in scriptures. and they are closely linked with the 56 references to Tyre. Now there are many aspects which help us with identifying who Tarshish is, and therefore who the king of the south is. At a high level, they are mentioned as a nation that is afar off. They are mentioned as an island. They are mentioned as a nation with many ships. They are mentioned as a nation that is at the uttermost parts of the earth. They are mentioned as a nation that trusts in God, and they are known as Tarshish. Let's have a look at some of these aspects in more detail. Genesis 10. Go back to where Brother Phil went last night. Verse 4. And 5. The sons of Javan, Elisha, and Tarshish, Kittim, and Dodanim. By these were the isles of the Gentiles divided in their lands, everyone after his town, after their families, in their nations. So this Tarshish power was amongst the islands of division. Further in this connection, let us go to Psalm 72. Verse 7, in his days shall the righteous flourish and abundance of peace so long as the moon endureth. He shall have dominion also from sea to sea and from the river unto the ends of the earth. They that dwell in the wilderness shall bow before him, and his enemy shall lick the dust. The kings of Tarshish and of the isles shall bring presents. The kings of Sheba and Seba shall offer gifts. So, here we see the identification of Tarshish as being an island nation. Well, if we go to Jonah and chapter 1. You'll see that by boat, from this area they can only go west. But they are a long way away from this territory. Jonah 1 verse 3, tell ye your children of it, and let your children tell their children, and their children another generation. Actually, I've got the wrong, yes, I'm Jonah, that's fine. Sorry about that. Jonah 1 and verse 3. But Jonah rose up to flee unto Tarshish from the presence of Yahweh, and went down to Joppa, and he found a ship going to Tarshish. So he paid the fare thereof, and went down into it to go with them unto Tarshish from the presence of Yahweh. This Tarshish power is a maritime power. Let's go to Isaiah chapter 2 and verse 16. Traded by the sea. Isaiah chapter 2 then and verse 16, and upon all the ships of Tarshish, and upon all pleasant pictures. And it was interesting when we were in the Viking Centre in York, as we were looking at the British history of around 950 AD, there were all sorts of things that the people of York made and sold things like leather shoes and tools and things like that made out of various metals. And we asked the guide as to whether they would have just sold locally, and he said they wouldn't have ever really made a lot of money if they were just trading locally. He said they sold everything that left the ports of Britain. So I thought that was kind of worth mentioning, that, you know, back in the Viking era in this country, Britain was a nation that traded by sea. Well, it most definitely, this trading power, this Tarshish power, is most definitely a trading power, and most clearly this can be seen in Ezekiel 27. Verse 12, Tarshish is thy merchant by reason of the multitude of all kind of riches, with silver, iron, tin and lead, they traded in thy fate. And it's interesting to read the whole of that chapter, that we don't have time to read right now. Second Chronicles, chapter 9, verse 21, shows Tarshish to be a global player, a seafaring player. It wasn't an easy trip, as it makes mention that the trip was made every 3 years. Within Ezekiel 27, we have here this mention of the metals that they dealt with, as we just read, of silver, iron, tin, and lead. Now I'm going to do Brother Richard Lister on this one, and that's just simply because I didn't want to go through with the hassle of setting up a projector, but I'll leave this to the side, and it shows all of the metals that were mined in the British Isles. And we can see lead, copper, lead, copper, lead, iron, lead, gold, lead, iron, lead, tin, and iron, etc. So I think that, I'll leave that to the side. We'll have a quick look at it later. But I think it is fairly well established that Britain was a nation, a big nation, that traded in those items. It's also part of a family. Within Ezekiel, let's go to Ezekiel 38. Ezekiel 38 and verse 13. Sheba and Dedan and the merchants of Tarshish, with all the young lions thereof, shall say unto thee, art thou come to take spoil? Hast thou gathered thy company to take a prey, to carry away silver and gold, to take away cattle and goods, to take a great spoil? So here we have a situation where we have a mother lion and a batch of young lions. Now, most of you will remember that picture from an appeal in World War I. Again, I'll leave it to the side, and my apologies that you can't see it. But it actually says the empire needs men. And it's got this massive picture of a big old lion with all of the young lions around. And it says, the overseas states all answer the call, helped by the young lions. The old lion defies his foes, enlist now. So I think again, Britain is well established as that old lion. We need to sort of pretty much now work through these without turning up the scriptures, just because we are going to desperately run out of time. Part of the family of lions we just mentioned, notably pro-Jewish, Isaiah 49. They are to assist the Jews to return. They are by and large a Protestant nation versus the beast nations. the Arabs, especially in the area of places like Saudi Arabia, as we see in Ezekiel 38. They are able and willing to challenge Russia in the latter days, Ezekiel 38. If anyone is taking a note, they might want to note these verses. They are to be humbled. The Tarshish power is to be humbled. Psalm 48, verse 7. Their ships there are described as being broken. They are to be restored. Psalm 60, verse 1. Restore us to your favour. When we talk about Tarshish as being a nation that's identified by ships, it is interesting that one of the reasons why Britain became so successful as a nation was because it was the only nation that had a full list, had a full log of every single boat that was either owned or used by the British people. So whenever Britain went to war and they wanted to convert some of these things for military purposes, the other nations had to go and look around. But Britain had a log and they could say, well, you know, these 20 boats we could convert in 2 days. And they had a log, they had a registration of where those, where the owners were at. And that was one of the reasons why Britain became so successful post-Spanish days, when Spain had a stronghold. Finally, on this point then, the ancient historian Herodotus, he wrote about 450 BC, and that would have been within 100 years of Ezekiel's time, and whose writings have survived, wrote, he says, nor do I know anything of the existence of islands called the Tin Islands, whence we get our tin. I have never found anyone who could give me first-hand information of the existence of the sea beyond Europe in the north and west. Yet, he says, it cannot be disputed that tin and amber do come to us from what one might call the ends of the earth. It may be, I've certainly been challenged, that how can we say that we can use Britain, especially the area of Cornwall in the southwest, how can we today use them as an element to identify who the Tarshish power is, because we don't trade in tin anymore. Lots of people say, well, you don't have tin there, you can't mine it. But actually, according to a geological survey a few years ago, they ascertained that in Cornwall there's about 500 years worth. There's about 500 years worth of tin to be mined. And there's only one reason why they don't mine it anymore, is because it's simply not commercially viable. But it is a land that still has literally tons of tin within it. We mentioned at the start, turning our attention now to Britain and Egypt, that the original king of the south was Egypt, and we have now identified the latter-day king of the south as Britain. If we had the time, we could go through the list that we used to identify the Tarshish power, and we could actually eliminate the nations that it most certainly doesn't apply to, by the way. And if you had a chart, you know, and you put, you know, Canada, you know, Russia, China, USA, Britain, you know, and so on and so forth, and had this list and said, well, okay, let's tick the box as to whether this could apply, you would only end up with one nation. There is no other nation on earth that you could put a tick in all of the boxes other than Britain. It is interesting to note the relationship which Britain has had with Egypt over the last 100 years. Britain first went into Egypt to counter the moves of Napoleon Bonaparte, who in fulfilment of the first trial of the Apocalypse chapter 16:2 had conquered Europe. It was Britain's mission to control the sea, in verse 3 of that 16th chapter of the Apocalypse, and thus contain Europe. This control of the sea limited Napoleon's exploits in the early 1800s and allowed Britain to later survive two world wars. This situation is described by Daniel as the king of the south, contending with the king, see revised version. And it was this background which made it possible for the development of a Jewish homeland in the Middle East. After the time of Napoleon, Europe was in turmoil for decades. The old Holy Roman Empire was demolished, and it was a while before Germany again rose to prominence. By the turn of the century, the king began to appear, and by 1914 became a visible alliance between Germany, Austria, and Turkey, the Ottoman Empire, known at the time as the Central Power. Britain and her allies, from their position of strength at sea and in Egypt, pushed or contended against him. The result of this was the removal of the Ottoman Empire, the Turks, from the Middle East, fulfilling part of the Sixth Final. Under the terms of the Balfour Declaration, it also commenced the Jewish return, so laying the basis for the coming of Christ and the establishment of the kingdom. Now, brethren and sisters, this situation continued on into World War II, where again Britain and her allies were pitched against the king, this time in the shape of the Rome-Berlin Axis. From their position in Egypt, the Allies contended against the Nazis, and at the Battle of El Alamein prevented Rommel from breaking through to the Jewish homeland in Palestine. The State of Israel was declared, as we said, in 1948, and Britain then came out of Egypt in 1956, having clearly established her identity as the King of the South during the time of the end. The Middle East, as we know it today, is largely of Britain's making, finishing touches only being supplied by the United Nations afterwards. Just as Britain had promised the Jews a national home in the Balfour Declaration, so she also promised Arabs their freedom and independence as a reward for helping the Allies during the World War. That would have been World War I. Consequently, Transjordan, which is now Jordan, was created, and they had a monarchy established in 1921. Egypt was made a monarchy in 1922, and after some internal strife, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia came into being in 1932. Following independence, Britain's links remained strong with the Arab world, and this of course caught her in the middle of the Jewish-Arab controversy and strife. Her withdrawal from the Middle East came largely as a result of that strife, and by 1967, Britain had completed her withdrawal from both Egypt and east of Suez. It was at this time that Britain seriously began to pursue the idea of entry into the European common market. Just as her European membership will prove to be a temporary matter, so also will the withdrawal from the Middle East prove to have been provisional. When the powers of Russia and Europe combine their forces to the King of the North and come like a whirlwind into the countries, the Allies will be found with Sheba and Dedan trying to protect their considerable interests. Now, what we've just said there is that Britain withdrew from Egypt. They withdrew from Egypt in the latter part of the last century. What is interesting is what Brother Thomas, so this was over 100 years before this came to pass, it's interesting what Brother Thomas has to say in Elpis Israel. He says, as I have said elsewhere, the lion power will not interest itself in behalf of the subjects of God's kingdom from pure generosity, or piety towards God, or love of Israel. But upon the principles which actuate all the governments of the world, upon those, namely, of the lust of dominion, the principle of self-preservation and self-aggrandizement. God, who rules the world and marks out the bounds of habitation for the nations, will make Britain a gainer by the transaction. He will bring her rulers to see the desirableness of Egypt, Ethiopia, and Seba, which they will be induced by the force of circumstances, probably, to take possession of them. And note what he says here. They will, however, before the battle of Armageddon, be compelled to retreat from Egypt. They will be compelled to retreat from Egypt and Ethiopia. For the king of the north shall stretch forth his hand upon the land of Egypt, which shall not escape, and the Libyans and Ethiopians shall be at his steps. Hence these will become the battleground for a time, until the seat of war is removed to the mountains of Israel, whereby the autocrat's discomfiture, the war is brought to an end between the image giant of Assyria and the lion of the north and east. The possession, he concludes, or ascendancy of Britain in Egypt, Ethiopia and Seba will naturally lead to the colonization of Palestine by the Jews. Well, in this second part, which was our largest part, we have 8 minutes left. So, we'll definitely have to curtail our remarks, but we'll fit in as much as we possibly can into those 8 minutes that do remain. So, brethren and sisters, having made certain the identity of the king of the south, or Tarshish power, we ask the question, what is the character of the power? Well, it is a power that is already in the area of Israel. For Ezekiel pronounces that the question of Britain and her allies to the king of the north will be, art thou come to take a spoil? Art thou come to take a spoil? If she, as a protective power, was not in the region, she would phrase the question differently. But the question, come to take a spoil, indicates that she is already there. But Thomas says that the tidings which go forth from the east and north, mentioned in Daniel 11, verse 44, refers to this question from the Tarshish power. Yes, he says it refers to the question from the Tarshish power. So tidings from the east and north equals Britain saying, effectively, art thou come to take a spoil? And he says that these measures of the British will be the means of luring on the autocrat to his destruction, having fulfilled the mission of his sacred Russia to put down rebellion, to plant the Greek cross on the dome of St. Sophia, and to prostrate Europe at his feet, he will next address himself to the world of establishing his dominion over the East. The prosperity of Egypt and Judea will tempt him to seize them for himself. For as the prophet said, he shall enter also into the glorious land, and many shall be overthrown, but these shall escape out of his hand, even Edom and Moab, and the chief of the children of Ammon. He will have proclaimed war against the east, and at the head of his vassal kings and their armies have invaded Syria. The war will be very much blood, and his hosts like a cloud to cover the land. Having overrun Syria and Persia, he will invade Egypt, Libya, and Ethiopia. For it is written, he shall stretch forth his hand also upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. But he shall have power over the treasures of gold and silver, and over the precious things of Egypt, and the Libyans and Ethiopians shall be at his steps. This subjugation of Egypt arouses at the indignation of Britain. That's what Brother Thomas says. This subjugation of Egypt arouses at the indignation of Britain. England's interference, he says, troubles him, for tidings out of the east and out of the north shall trouble him. Therefore he shall go forth with great fury to destroy and utterly to make away many. Judea will now feel the weight of his power. He will lay siege to Jerusalem and take it, for he shall pitch his palatial tent in the glorious holy mountain. Yet though thus far triumphant, he will come to his end, and none shall help him. So, brethren and sisters and young people, the mission for Britain and her young lions is to protect Israel. But on this occasion, she utterly fails. Verse 44 of Daniel 11 says that those tidings, the trouble, he shall go forth with great fury to destroy and utterly to make away many. Brother Philip mentioned last evening the image of Nebuchadnezzar is to stand erect in the Holy Land. Russia takes Turkey, then Egypt. Egypt, we are told, is given into the hand of a cruel lord, which amounts to the Gogian host. But Daniel 11 paints the picture that Edom, Moab, and Ammon shall escape, with Isaiah chapter 19 painting the picture of the Jordan area and Moab being a place or becoming a place of refuge. Yes, the king of the south is to be expelled from the land of Israel, but it's worth noting that Edom, Moab and Ammon will never be conquered by Russia. Dedan and Yemen also, which are in the Saudi area, will also be with Tarshish. We don't have time to look at it now, but Isaiah 19 is a wonderful depiction of the future, showing Moab the ultimate refuge. Britain has never persecuted the Jews. They have generally maintained a pro-Semitic attitude. They will be compelled to protect the Jews, no matter what their foreign policies might be today or tomorrow, in the day when it matters, in the latter days that is, they will be compelled, ever against their own natural will if need be, they will be there together with their young lions in an attempt to protect Israel as that nation with overshadowing wings. The subject of the lion is an interesting one. The young lions, the old lion, the mother lion and the young lions, is an interesting one. And I'm going to read a little extract from the 1948 Christadelphian, and it was written by a brother, W. Taunton. And it's interesting what he has to say on this subject. And just after we've read this, we will bring our remarks pretty much to an abrupt end. For otherwise, rather, we'll end up being up here for another hour. So, the young lions thereof, Ezekiel 38, verse 13. And the writer says this: investigation concerning the original words used in the Hebrew was suggested as the obvious course to be followed, with a result that was not only reassuring, but also very illustrative of the fitness of the expression "the young lions" as applied by the Spirit to Britain's associated nations. He said, in the Old Testament, the usual Hebrew word for lion is ari, A-R-I, from a root meaning to tear, the lion being the chief among such tearing and devouring beasts. When a lion's whelp is meant, the word gur is used, G-U-R, indicating that it is still a suckling dependent upon its mother, and not one capable of tearing and devouring for itself. Neither of these words used in Ezekiel 38, verse 13. But the word kephir, K-E-P-H-I-R, which is applied to a lion's whelp or suckling when it ceases to be such and can look after itself. Of this word, Justinian says in his Hebrew lexicon, a young lion already weaned and having begun to ravin. Wilson in his lexicon says the word describes a young lion, old enough to roar, going forth afraid. Parker says of the word that it is a young lion when he first begins to hunt and shift for himself. The now rambling lion is so named kephir, from a root meaning a village, a place of covering or shelter, in view of his frequent hiding himself and lurking in dens and coverts. This association of independence is shown clearly in Psalm chapter 17 and verse 12. The two words gur and kephir are used for whelp and young lion in Ezekiel 19 verses 2 to 6, and these verses illustrate perfectly the point. We have long been satisfied that there was a close connection between the use of the words and the heraldic symbol of Britain, but evidently there is an even closer association. What an amazingly apt description we here see of the nations of the Commonwealth in view of their changed relationship to Britain as a result of the Statute of Westminster, Westminster substituting for the former ties of the Empire, which were necessary during their early years, so tenuous a bond as a common loyalty to the Crown in a free and voluntary association with another country. In their national infancy, these nations were but sacklings, each one a gur. Now when the unfolding of the plan is revealing for all to see the general trend of events in Europe and Asia, with the growing tension between Russia and the Anglo-Saxon peoples, these empire nations are matured and can and will render aid to Britain when the clash occurs. We can therefore rest confident that the end being promised will assuredly come, and that when the Lions of Tarshish are unequal to the task of defending God's land, the Lion of Judah will prevail, and that forever. Our manifest concern is so to comport ourselves now that we may be numbered amongst his associates. So when Brother Phil last night put up the map of the Gogian Empire, so France and Germany, all those European countries with Russia, I don't know, brethren and sisters, about you, but I kind of thought the vastness of the territory of the King of the North is astonishing. The territories over which will be this man at the top, the emperor or the autocrat. Germany and France are exceptionally wealthy countries. In fact, they are listed in the top five wealthiest nations in the world. But likewise, brethren and sisters, if we were to show the countries that are with Great Britain, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, etc., their territory and power is vast as well, but not sufficient to prevent Gog from going to take its spoil, whatever that spoil is. Both Brother Thomas and Brother Roberts comment on the fact that Russia go up to the land of unwalled villages, and they both say that's typical of Russia. So, brethren and sisters, we have this situation where this protecting power, we're going to close now in the next minute or so, we have this situation where this Tarshish protectorate is forced out of Egypt, unable to hold back the flow of this Gogian invasion. Like a whirlwind, they enter upon the land, and when they do that, the image, Nebuchadnezzar's image, stands erect. Man, as the protector, is unable to help the Jews. Man is unable to protect the Jews. Brother Phil mentioned last night, we don't know how long it will be. Russia might appear to be the king of the world. Forget about king of the north. They might appear to be king of the world for a few days, for a few months, or Brother Robert says somewhere, might even be longer. To the rest of the world, when this happens, seemingly, the political landscape of the world that predominantly has been Western for a long time will appear to be on the brink of changing. But Yahweh, in that great time of trouble, at the request of his people, who through much persecution, will humble themselves, and they will seek Yahweh. They will know that in all of their technological and medical advances for the last 50 to 100 years, all of the wonderful help that they've had from Britain and the US and other Commonwealth countries, those that have been pro-Jewish, none of those will be able to assist them. Then shall my fury come up in my face, saith the army. Ezekiel 38, verse 18. This is the eyes as a flame of fire and countenance as lightning of the multitudinous man, brethren and sisters. The rainbowed angel appears in Zechariah 14, verse 3. Zechariah 9:14, we read, "Then shall Yahweh go forth and fight against those nations with whirlwinds of Teman." And from Isaiah 63, verses 1 to 6, please read that in your own time. It is obvious that Bosra is a very important key battle, the first encounter with the Gobian forces. It is at Bosra that the garments of the rainbowed angel of Yahweh, the man of war, are stained with the blood of Gog. There is an added significance to this in the fact that Teman and Bosra are in Edom. Edom, which means red, standing for the flesh of sin, is the typical enemy of God's people. This comes out clearly in Ezekiel 38, just preceding the group of chapters, chapters 36 to 39, describing Israel's regathering and blessing in the last days. Edom is to be a perpetual desolation when the whole world rejoiceth. Edom is apparently to be a perpetual, desolate, burning memorial to the subjugation and destruction of the flesh during the millennium. Psalm 48, verse 4. Psalm 48 actually is a very interesting psalm. Verse 4 speaks of Russia, Brother Thomas says in Eureka. And a few verses on, we are told that the ships of Tarshish shall be broken with an east wind. The power which never had any chance on land against this Gobian invasion, she never had a chance on land, is now also broken on the sea. The reputation of being king of the sea on the high waters will lay in ruin. That power will come, brothers and sisters, who is mighty to save. Mighty to save. Isaiah 30, verse 27, and Revelation 19, verse 11. I'd like to do two things to close. I'd like to read Daniel chapter 11. My apologies that we missed out on the timings this morning. But if we run too much over, then the whole day will run out of light, so we won't subject you to that. So Daniel 11, verse 45, "And he shall plant the tabernacles of his palace between the seas in the glorious holy mountain, yet he shall come to his end." The king of the north. "He shall come to his end, and none shall help him." And by way of exhortation, we'll conclude with the words of Brother Grocott. And it's a nice summary. He says, chapter 11 is a detailed history of the conflicts between the king of the south and the king of the north, the two parts of Alexander's empire, Egypt and Syria, between which lay Palestine, the Holy Land, their common battleground, just as today. As time passes on, nations come and go, and Rome enters the picture as the king of the north by the conquest of that territory. The Roman power develops into the papal power, into whose hands the people of God are given for 1260 years. Much history is telescoped into these few verses. In verse 40, our attention is turned to the time of the end. There is still a king of the north and a king of the south. The ancient enmity still exists, and God's land is still at the crossroads and the battleground, just as we see today. As the final crisis arises in verse 40, the king of the south pushes against the king of the north. Then the latter, the king of the north, comes forth like a whirlwind and carries all before him. At the zenith of his power, he meets his end, verse 45, between the seas in the glorious holy mountain. Chapter 12 is the final picture. This time of the great power and the final destruction of the king of the north is described, verse 1, as a time of trouble on the earth such as never has been. But it is also a time of great deliverance. Thy people shall be delivered. It is the time, verse 2, of the awakening of the dead and the rewarding of God's faithful servants of all ages. They that be wise, verse 3, shall shine as the brightness of the firmament. We know that this great day is even now upon us. Are we among the wise? Are our lives filled and dominated by the consciousness of these great things? Do we put all present things in the background, meaningless? Do we feel the intensity of Daniel's yearning and supplication, But thou, O Daniel, verse 4, shut up the words and seal the book, even till the time of the end. Here is one asked another, verse 6, how long shall it be to the end of these wonders? They speak, brethren and sisters, of the 1260, the 1290, and the 1335-year periods. Here again, a final 75-year period is indicated, related to the rebirth of Israel, and we are in the midst of it. At the moment, these periods appear to run successively, 1917, 1947, and 1992. But it is not for us to know, only be wide awake to the possibility and to recognize that it is certainly time of the end. Daniel heard the mystic reply. He heard, but he understood not, verse 8, for the vision was not for Daniel. The aged prophet had now come to the end of his long exile. His weary years of prayer and concern for his people were now over. Then said I, verse 8, O my Lord, what shall be the end of these things? And he said, go thy way, Daniel, for the words are closed up and sealed till the time of the end. Go thy way till the end be, for thou shalt rest and stand in thy lot at the end of thy days. May, brethren and sisters, it be our lot to stand with him, the man greatly beloved.